top of their lungs, Happy New Year. It's just 3 days from now, New Year. You know, time not only to get a little fashnushka, get a little drunk, but to wish each other a year of happy year, a year of peace, a year of sustenance. Think of it. We articulated these same wishes last New Year, and the New Year before that, and the New Year before that. Every New Year, we pronounce those vibes. And 2 or 3 weeks later, those wishes become old. Wars continue. Health issues must be met. And the stock market tumbles. Huh? I mean, what happened to all those New Year wishes? You see, what's new on January 1st doesn't take long to become old, sometimes almost meaningless. The New Year becomes old much, much too soon. A rule that applies to just about every innuendo of life. But the challenges we face is not how to get accustomed to the new becoming old. The big question is whether we can accept the change that time brings. You know, I often wonder when I attend a happy Brit Milah, baby naming celebration, I wonder whether the excited mother or father are able to perceive at that joyous moment, you know what, that all too soon, that infant is going to ask them for the keys to the car. Will mommy and daddy be ready to accept that change? You know, the longer we perceive a person or an idea, the more we seem to be convinced that change is next to impossible. There are fixations that are almost impossible to change. So much of the history of the Jewish people is based on that notion, as articulated by none other than in God, when he told our people to get out of Egypt. You're finished with slavery. Today's parsha. We were on our way to the promised land. Finally, after so many years of slavery. Well, wait a minute, not so fast. Literally not so fast. God directed us away from a quick journey to Canaan, which would have taken only 2 weeks. To adapt from slavery to freedom, we needed 40 years, not 2 weeks. None other than the Almighty made it very, very clear that we Israelites would not accept change, much as it would have benefited us. It took a whole new generation until we could adapt from the old, even slavery, to the new, freedom in the promised land. You see, reluctance to adapt to new social environments, be they fiscal rules, spiritual perceptions, or religious rights, they seem to be a standard that impacts us every single day. The struggle between the old and the new goes back to the days of our biblical ancestors, and it's still with us now. A simple example will do. And really simple it is. Would you deposit your funds in any bank that refuses to give you interest on that money? No matter how low the market is. We want that interest payment. But the Torah prohibits us to take any interest. Clearly, we no longer apply that rule. In consonance with rabbinic laws that established the Prus Bull, allowing Jews to take interest, circumventing Torah law. The legal explanation is not important here at this moment. But change from the old to the new certainly is now the norm. When it happened, traditionalists objected. How dare we change the holy prohibition instilled by God at Mount Sinai? But today, pocket interest payments is the unchallenged standard among every single Jew. The new replaced the old. So, all right. So the new is coming. The new year is coming. It's coming in a few days. And you'll celebrate. Right? Maybe a drink or two. And then you'll sit around your kosher dinner table and enjoy a scripturally made chicken along with a glass of milk. What? Wait a minute. Did I say chicken and milk at your kosher table? You're thinking, how can Rabbi Dershowitz not know that it violates the most basic Torah rule not to mix milk and meat? Well, happily, many of you know, because you're passionate about study of Torah and history, that the Torah considers chicken to be parv, like fish, vegetables. Plain and simple, no text in the Torah prohibits consuming chicken and butter. But it's the Chazal, it's our scholars of old, who instituted that prohibition that today is nothing less than a total and absolute law within the rules of kashrut. Chicken is viewed the same as meat now when it comes to separation of dairy and meat, no matter what the Torah says. So when it comes to taking interest on your money, in no uncertain terms, Torah law is nullified. When it comes to the rule of kashrut, Torah law is enhanced. The new replaces the old. Now, come with me, if you will, to the 10th century in the Rhine River area of Europe, France, Germany, in that area, northern France. I want to introduce you to Rabbeinu Gershom, who took upon himself to make a major change in Torah law that totally shocked Jewish society. You know, today, at the end of 2013, what would you think of a Jewish man who absolutely insisted on marrying two or three women or more at the same time? Not a Mormon, a Jew. I speak of a Jew in love with Torah, immersed in everything that it teaches. That Jew uses the Torah as his prime model of behavior. Why not have five wives? Abraham had three. Jacob's four wives gave us the foundation of the 12 tribes of Israel. But don't even ask me about King David and King Solomon, huh? How many wives they had. But David and Solomon, they're our heroes. They represent nothing less than the genesis of the messianic passion for which we pray every day. But Rabbeinu Gershom instituted a takana, a so-called temporary correction. He instituted a takana to the Torah. No more polygamy. In the Ashkenazi world, Jewish men may marry no more than one woman. Never mind Torah law. We must adhere to the standards of our contemporary society, where monogamy rules. Rabbeinu Gershom looked about him. The evolving European society proclaimed by its actions the impropriety and social disgrace for a man to have more than one wife. No Jewish event spurred that decision. Just the secular world around Rabbeinu Gershom. Frankly, the norms of Christian Europe delineated the new Jewish standard of marriage. I would imagine that Rabbeinu Gershom's ruling in his day was a shocker to countless Jewish men. How dare anybody change the rule of Torah, which after all is God's eternal gift to us? Tell me, name me one rabbi today, Reform, Conservative, Orthodox, who would agree that today Judaism permits polygamous marriage. We changed the old and came up with the new. In the 10th century, that was painful to accept. I assure you, it was very, very painful to accept by many Jewish young men. But today, try to even argue on behalf of polygamous marriage in the Jewish world, and you'll be shunned by society. The new replaced the old. No traditional observant Jew today would observe a pagan holiday. I mean, not even the less than observant Jews. Excuse me, I take that all back. I'm wrong. Totally wrong. Most Jews today have no problem observing the secular New Year. Coming up just in a few days, right? We'll happily celebrate the New Year 2014 when the clock strikes midnight. Did Rabbeinu Gershom instill in us the conviction that it's not only okay, but necessary for us to follow the norms of the society of our time? After all, the origins of the secular New Year is a pagan festival. But now, it's popular, universal, certainly among Jews as well. So it's just for a moment. Let's define who is a Jew. You and I know that other than a convert, a Jew is a person whose birth mother was Jewish. Not the father, the birth mother. But please don't try to convince our ancestors of that totally acceptable contemporary halakhic definition. For the first 2 years or so of our existence, the religion of the child reflected the father's faith, not the mother's faith. But once again, change in Jewish law arose not by dint of Jewish activity, but what was dramatically and sorrowfully, I must say, changed by activity in non-Jews. It's a bit sensitive, but regrettably factual. When Roman soldiers violated married Jewish women, there was no way to know who the infant's genetic father was. So Torah law was changed because it was obvious who the mother is. 2,000 years of practice was thrown out. People other than Jews influenced the decision, and from then on, to use only matrilineal descent was used to determine the child's faith. Obviously, that halakha remains in place today, even though we could easily apply DNA testing to determine who the father is. So where do we draw the line? Annually, there are American Jews who struggle with the overwhelming impact of Christmas on our culture. Not surprisingly, it is the only clear Christian-based holiday that is also Congress-approved as a legal national holiday. Even the Supreme Court said that national observance of Christmas does not violate the constitutional rule of separation of church and state. But how can even that court ruling justify Jews celebrating Christmas? On the other hand, what about the increasing number of states that now permit same-sex marriage? The norms of society, which Rabbeinu Gershom used as his guideline in the 10th century, and which created a huge change in Jewish law in his day, that seemed to point to our need to accept that halakhically objectionable posture of same-sex marriage. Frankly, personally, I would be adverse to officiating such a marriage. I'm an old-timer, you see. But that's only my personal emotional feeling. Torah law has been turned around legitimately many, many times. So the debate must be based on the precedents of our scholars without diminishing our Jewish identity by one iota. Look, New Year's around the corner. And so are huge, huge challenges to the happy drama, if I can use that term, of Jewish identity, Jewish practices, Jewish institutions, Jewish norms. Nothing and no one will ever minimize our identity if we continue the practice of our rituals. Nothing and no one will ever, ever diminish our positive, creative role in society if we celebrate the beauty of our holidays with happy passion, family togetherness, whenever possible, of course. Allow me to present to you a realistic comparison as to how Jews around the world tend more to be aware of secular values than Jewish ones. A simple but pragmatic experiment. January 1, that'll mark the onset of the new year of 2014. But tell me, how many Jews know what is scheduled for the next day, January 2? Now, I'm not a betting man, but if you could prove to me that more than 10% of the world's Jewish population today would know what will be January 2, I'll give an extra $1,000 contribution to Tzedakah. I won't keep you waiting. January 2, the day after January 1, is Thursday, but it's Rosh Chodesh Shabbat, the new month of Shabbat, when we'll read the Torah, say the Hallel, and even do the Musaf service, even though it's Thursday. Significantly, we make special note of the fact that on the 15th day of Shabbat, we mark Tu B'Shvat, which not only makes us cognizant of the reforestation of Israel, but the whole issue of how Judaism has viewed the need to protect the world's environment long before it became a political, popular, contemporary issue. Here again, we touch on the way in which powerful Jewish tradition was radically changed by dint of the way in which the world around us acts. 150 years ago, it was considered sacrilege for any Jew to even suggest that it is we who should make the effort to return to our promised land. When they chanted L'shana haba b'Yerushalayim, be it at Yom Kippur, at the end of Pesach, whatever, they absolutely positively knew that it would be only in the days of the Mashiach when that would happen. Only messianic intervention can return us to the land of our forefathers. Look, if you don't believe me, just ask the members of the Bilu movement, B'nei Yaakov L'chuva Na'aleh, that's the Hebrew term. Young Jews from Odessa, who toward the end of the 19th century decided to make Aliyah to Palestine and to work the land. This group of enthusiastic Jews was totally rejected by Jews who had already settled in Palestine. Why? For the purpose of worshiping. And many for the worshiping on behalf of their families in Eastern Europe. The Mashiach hadn't come yet. How dare those young Bilu Jews take such a radical step on their own? The Bilu, no matter their idealism, they decided to settle in Eretz Yisrael. They lost the struggle. They had to leave Palestine, today Israel, rejected by the Jewish messianic ideology centuries old. But eventually the world in which we Jews live turned things around. I don't have to tell you all the circumstances. It was political Zionism, which said it's not the Messiah, but we, with our energy, our fiscal resources, our political clout, that we're going to achieve the task. It was not Jewish religious needs, the belief in Mashiach, but our response to what was happening in the world around us that prompted personalities such as Pinsker and Ahad Ha'am and Bialik and Herzl to respond. Thus, hardly noticed, one day is January 1, the second day is January 2. But that's Rosh Chodesh Shvat. That triggers in our memory, if we know what it's all about, all those factors. Now we take matters into our own hands. Not the Mashiach, but the Jewish National Fund. We purchase land in Israel, we plant trees, we build water dams, open the Negev to human habitation. It's society around us, not rabbinic interpretation, not even the Torah text in this case, that caused the huge change that brought about the Jewish state of Israel as we know it today. So Tu B'Shvat is coming, but its popularity among Jews doesn't compare to the popularity of the oncoming New Year, 2014. If you don't believe me, I ask you to look backwards a little bit. Just 15 days ago, it was the 10th of Tevet, when we marked the horror of the onset of Nebuchadnezzar's siege of Jerusalem in the year 3336, in the Hebrew calendar. That event led to the destruction of Jerusalem's temple. Now, compare, please. Compare the number of Jews cognizant of January 1 with the ones aware of this past December 13th. And the horror of Jerusalem's destruction. That was January 16th. January 16th is Tu B'Shvat, the renewal of Israel, in that sense. Today we're right in the middle of between these two events. Events hardly noticed by Jews compared to the pagan festival of New Year's. Let me tell you, you will best survive if that percentage of the relative awareness between January 1 and January 2 improves. January 1, the origins of a pagan festival. We celebrated, not bad, okay. December 13, Babylonians were determined not only to destroy the temple, but to destroy the Jewish existence by exiling us from Jerusalem. Do most Jews remember that? January 1, New Year celebration among Jews. That won't be hindered. January 15, how many Jews will take note of Tu B'Shvat and the renewal of our ancient homeland through our own determined acts and deeds? You know what? We seem to be putting the emphasis on the wrong syllable. We accept secular norms, but does that mean that we should forget the lessons of Jewish history? Pagan-driven New Year's? January 1, yes. Torah-induced Rosh Chodesh? January 2, no. Look, Jewish identity and the desire to continue our 4,000-year-old history and ethical values can and will be perpetuated where more Jews learn about our rich heritage. Let's talk tachlis, practical applications. We should not allow our children to leave religious school at the age 13, bar mitzvah. We must study Jewish values in adult classes. We must talk about it at home. When the Shema Yisrael echoes in prayer every morning, and yes, when we tuck our little ones into bed every night, then God will live in our hearts. Then, when we learn, we must study our Jewish traditions and how to project them into the future with love of Torah, love of Hebrew, love of Israel, love of ethics, all enshrined through the love of God. Shabbat Shalom.